ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisson Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello again. Welcome to The Science Show with me, Robin Williams.
And me, Belinda Smith.
Belle, can you believe it's been 10 years since physicists announced they detected the first gravitational wave? Later in the program, I speak to the gravitational wave astrophysicist about what's been discovered since. We'll also hear about new research into seagrasses and how we might help them survive as oceans heat up.
A glimmer of hope for their future, maybe. But what about the future of Australian research? So last week on The Science Show, Robin, you mentioned the Ambitious Australia report. It said that Australia must reform R&D systems now, and it gave 20 recommendations ranging from establishing 6 national innovation themes to encouraging connections between universities, industry and government. So what's at stake here? What do we have to lose if those recommendations go unheeded? To find out, I spoke to Jazz Chambers, President of Science and Technology Australia. The report says Australia's R&D sector is currently an underperforming system that is the result of often trifling incremental improvements, risk aversion and band-aid solutions. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it is a fair assessment, actually, of a system under pressure, needing a whole of government review and a whole of government approach to it. So yes, I think it's a fair assessment.
If nothing changes, what do we lose? Plenty of people listening will not be working in science, or they don't know people who work in research or innovation. How will it affect people who don't work inside those realms?
The STEM industry underpins so much of what we do and what we eat and what we buy off the shelf. So putting it in context for the people who don't work in this system, this is how we improve water quality. This is how we improve our crop yields. And also this is how we make decisions when it comes to things like the weather and what's happening and do we need to move groups of people. Without having a really robust system that underpins that decision-making support that occurs, that's what's at risk here, is the way in which we live our lives and the information that we rely on to make decisions.
Why is it important that we retain that locally? I'm sure some people might think, oh, well, as long as other people are thinking about these things, it doesn't really matter. But yeah, why is it so crucial that we keep all of that within Australia?
Well, I think, first of all, is to understand how Australia has such an extraordinary R&D system that has been invested in over a long period of time, but that investment has been declining. And that's also against the cost of actually doing that research. This is an expensive exercise. Like many other things that are increasing in price, so is doing research and development. But we do need that to underpin. So to your question around why can't we just outsource that to other parts of the world? It's important to understand that the scientific, with many, many other countries, industry, is actually a worldwide endeavour. But if Australia doesn't have a system that can give and receive inside that cooperative global system, then that becomes pretty difficult to get the information that we want, the knowledge that we want, and the deals. So to give you some context around that as just an example, Australia doesn't have satellites that can be used to tell the weather. We rely heavily on other countries to give us that information. We have some of the best people in the world who can then interpret that information for us in our country, in our region, but we actually require that cooperation to exist globally. So it already happens, and it's important for our own local context that we're able to do things like tell the weather, understand what's happening with tides and other parts of how the planet works, as well as build our own system so that we are resilient when it comes to shocks. We've got a shock right now going on around energy and oil. And Australia, you can see how reliant we are on other parts of the world for supply chain. It is important when it comes to things like pandemics, et cetera, that we have the ability to turn our minds and then produce something as a solution.
I think you're right. Just mentioning the pandemic, that it became quite obvious that when you start from behind and something like that happens, it's really hard to catch up. Whereas if you're leading or at least a front runner in that area, it's much easier to react and come up with ways to deal with these things as we go instead of scrambling to get to a point where we can actually start to make those decisions.
Absolutely.
So in the Ambitious Australia report, it gave 20 recommendations. Which of those do you think should be implemented most urgently?
For people in the STEM industry, this is the multi-generational, intergenerational opportunity to change the system. And it's important that people in the industry take a read of this, because the way that we have interpreted this is an invitation for change. It's not going to happen overnight. And the way in which the report was provided was as a package of recommendations. So when you ask what's the most important thing, actually it's pretty difficult to respond to any one aspect of this, because they are interconnected recommendations and there is a flow on for each one. What we're asking the government to do is to move quickly and seize the opportunity and the momentum that's been created by the release of the report. And we're very keen that the STEM industry is invited in to work with government on co-design of the implementation of the report. I think one of the things, if you page 27, go look at that. That's the proposed governance structure.
Okay, yep. Flipping to page 27 now.
Yep, great. So that outlines the governance recommendation around this. And you'll see on that page, in that picture, there are a series of pillars, which are health, agriculture and resources, technology, energy, environment. What that represents to us, if you really think about that, it is the implications for most ministerial portfolios, from health to ag and environment. That's the opportunity. Science does not sit in one portfolio in government. It goes across all of them. And that picture represents the opportunity for science to come into the industry conversation, because it already underpins it. So it's making more obvious that connection and how R&D and innovation can produce great outcomes for each of those areas, which have been prioritised. What I would say about that picture that's probably missing a little bit there, but it's all through the report, is where discovery research fits into this. That's an important aspect that we definitely want people to understand. Not everything is going to just be shoved into these pillars. There is absolutely the opportunity for discovery research and that foundation work to continue.
Jazz Chambers, President of Science and Technology Australia. And Robin, I recently came across a great example of homegrown innovation. So just picture this for a second. There's an oil spill in the ocean, devastating to marine ecosystems. But then a fleet of dolphins arrive to help.
Yes, they really are so clever and green.
Okay, so to be clear, we're not talking about real-life dolphins here, but dolphin-shaped robots, self-powered ones that operate autonomously, which can swim out to a spill, slurp up the oil, store it in a tank in their belly, and deposit it safely somewhere else. This is the vision of Dr. Atul Raman from RMIT University.
Basically, I'm an electronic materials engineer. I like to play with the materials and then want to see that when we developed or engineer a material, what's the fruitful things that we can use it for the benefit of human being, for the environment.
So you and your team recently came up with an oil-absorbing device that takes inspiration from a couple of sea animals, and you got it here in front of us. Now, I've seen it described as an electronic dolphin. It is kind of dolphin-shaped. That's, gosh, I don't know, it's about as long as an A4 piece of paper. At the front of the dolphin, the snout,
It looks like a little hose with something on the end. What is on the end of the snout?
So that's the material that we are using. This material can actually separate the oil and water. This material is actually hydrophobic in nature and oleophilic in nature. That means that it hates water, but it likes oil. So when it actually takes the water, it absorbs the oil, then there's a pump here, and that pump actually can hover up those oil from that foam. And there's a container in the belly of the dolphin, and that oil actually is stored in the container.
Okay, so the snout sort of picks up the oil from the water. The pump pulls the oil from the snout foam and puts it into a tank in the dolphin's belly.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
And so the foam that's in the snout, how does it love oil so much and how does it hate water so much? What is it about it that gives it those properties?
So it's a polyurethane foam. So we functionalize that materials and the foam with the nanomaterials to create a sea urchin-like structure. We can't see it without the microscope. So if you can see it through the microscope, you can see lots of spikes like the sea urchin. And there's a small spike grown on the bigger spike, and it's functionalized with these materials to actually hate the water.
Is that because of the surface tension of the water droplet? It can't cling to the surface because it's all spiky, so it just kind of rolls away.
Yes.
And you've tried the dolphin out. Obviously, it left a bit of water on my notes. How does it go with things like waves?
This is now in a small prototype to apply this one or employ this one in the waves, in the real ocean conditions. It should be a bit bigger. Once it is that kind of big size, I think that it can sustain the waves.
How big are we talking? Are we talking like a real dolphin size? Because they're huge.
Yeah, that's what actually I am. If it is like that, then because the idea is that in the belly, how much oil we want to collect, it depends on that how strong is my pump is. If my pump is very bigger, then the dolphin belly vessel should be a larger one and the container should be a larger one. And then with that ratio, the dolphin should be a bigger one. From that things that I can imagine that should be like a normal dolphin, for example. But we have to see that how can we actually 3D print that larger scale dolphin. That's the things that I need to find out.
Ah, right. Okay. So the real oil collecting dolphin shaped robot would be much bigger than this shoe sized prototype. One, so that it's stable enough to withstand the waves that it might experience on the open ocean, but also two, it can accommodate a bigger pump and tank and collect more oil while it's out and about. Like you said, it does sound like there's a way to go before we get to that point. Now, your team's also developed a mobile phone app that can let you control the robot and take it to where it needs to go. How do you keep track of where the robot is? Does it have cameras?
So basically, the camera will be on the two eyes of the dolphin. That two eyes will be like a two camera to actually monitor its movement.
And how is it powered? Is that just a little battery in that one?
Yeah, it's currently powered with the battery, but probably we can attach some kind of electromagnetic materials or the energy harvester. While it is moving on the water, it can harvest energy to actually power itself. And that kind of things that we can envision, but it's a long way to go.
I imagine there'd be a fleet of these getting around and soaking up oil spills. Would there be any capacity to use AI to help direct them to where they need to go?
Exactly. Basically, if we can see our RoboVac at home, how do they clean? They go to any part of our home, collect the dust and come back to the station and drop all the dust there. And then again, go back to collect the further dust. So this is what I want to do. So it means that we want to control it through a kind of artificial intelligence that we can map the area where the spill of the oil is. And then after the mapping, the dolphin will go exactly that area, will collect the oils. When that container is full, it come back to its original stations and put all the oils there in the container and go back again to collect the further oils. That's how it will actually work for day and night together.
Dr. Atul Rahman from RMIT University. Now, a small spark of hope in this tumultuous world we're living in.
Meanwhile, another bold experiment. LIGO, a triumph of physics and precision engineering that's been picking up the tiniest ripples in space-time for more than a decade now. Here's Katharina Hadiwanu,
a gravitational wave astrophysicist at Caltech, LIGO HQ.
Did you learn to say that name in Greece?
Yes, I was born there, raised there, and moved to the US when I was in my 20s to study.
And it's quite convenient because some of the mathematical notations are in Greek alphabet.
Absolutely.
Did that help?
It helps even more when you are reading about a different field, because I feel like I have a massive advantage when I'm reading biology fields, because I understand half the terms, what they mean etymologically, than most people.
How long have you been here?
I've been in Caltech since 2020, for 5 years now.
So was that the middle or the beginning of LIGO?
That was halfway through the 10-year period during which LIGO has been making observations.
And what did you do on the day the announcement came that you'd found what you needed?
I was, just as everyone else, watching the announcement, admiring what had just happened, struggling to believe that it was all real.
Did you know, of course, that there was a part of Australia that was also part of LIGO, David Blair in Perth?
Absolutely, yeah. We have been collaborating with this team, which has also been instrumental in what has happened in the next 10 years, which is analyzing the data, but also in building the detectors, the instrumental side of the detectors.
How do you get this information? Isn't it a completely different sort of wave, taking much more time than, say, light or radio?
Yeah, it's a completely different sort of wave, which is why we try to build an analogy to sound. It's not really sound. Think of it as a completely different thing than what we're used to. Completely different new ways of understanding the universe.
The signals coming in, are they of always a catastrophic event, such as very large bodies colliding?
Yes. So everything that LIGO has detected to date is a catastrophic event. Either the two black holes collided with each other, or the two neutron stars, because we have detected those signals as well, collided with each other. The original objects were destroyed in the process and gave rise to a final different black hole or different object. Everything that LIGO has seen had a beginning when we started observing it and an end.
May I ask you a couple of very innocent questions? When I read more and more about black holes, sometimes I'm told that it's not as if there is a very, very unbelievably dense object hanging there, but it's more a presence, its effect on what's around it. Mm-hmm. And if it's not really there in that way, how can it collide with something else that's not really there either and have such a huge consequence?
Yeah, it's a great way to think about it, because I also like thinking about black hole mergers as nothing colliding with nothing. And then what comes out of it is literally the most bright event you have ever seen. Not bright in light, bright in gravitational waves. So what happens is the space-time around the black holes carries the effect of what is happening at the center of the black hole, carries this curvature of space-time that is the signature of gravity. And it's this space-time between the two black holes that is interacting with each other, and that is what is causing the collision.
Do you have a picture yourself of what is colliding with what?
It's not a nothingness, not a boring nothingness, though. It's a complicated nothingness. If the structure of space-time was boring in the sense that it was flat, there was no black hole there, yeah, nothing would happen. But there is a black hole there, so the vacuum itself is not nothing. The vacuum itself carries this structure that we think of as black holes.
When it comes to neutron stars, of course, there is something there, and it is a lump. It must be under gigantic effect with two neutron stars colliding.
Yeah, so there is matter there. So actually, when neutron stars collide, it's literally when you have like a car crash. It's a mess. You have debris flowing around all over the place. It is literally like a collision of matter. But at the same time, even when the two neutron stars have not collided yet, even when it's just the gravity around them that is interacting, you still get a gravitational wave from that stage. But at the very end of this process, you do have the dramatic collision that you don't have in black holes. In fact, if you look at some of the simulations of black hole merges, sometimes I think of it as a very peaceful process. Nothing really dramatic happens in the sense you don't see things exploding, fireworks, anything. You just have two black holes. They almost peacefully come together and merge. But in this process, they emit so much energy that it would be like, for example, multiple times the mass of the sun was evaporated into energy and was coming toward us. But that energy is not in something that we humans can understand with our eyes. It's not light that you can see. It's not a bright explosion. It is energy that travels through the space-time around us.
And when you get signals from gravitational waves, as you do here in LIGO, what do you analyze? It was always the same signal, or is it vastly different, and how do you picture it?
Oh, sometimes they are very similar, sometimes they are very unique. Sometimes we get signals from black holes that are very similar to another pair of black holes that collided last month. And when we see that signal, we say, oh, great, that looks very similar to something we've seen. It teaches us something about the demographics of black holes. If you see a lot of them, you understand what they look like in aggregate. Every once in a while, you get one that looks completely different. And I have to admit, these are the ones that get us the most excited, because the black holes that created that signal have something unique that we haven't seen before. Some have very large spins, which seems to be a rare thing. Some are close enough that the signal is extremely loud, like a signal that we observed about a year ago that was by far the loudest we have detected and gave us a really good picture of the process with which black holes merge and collide. This very strong gravity, as gravity collides with gravity, as we were saying, gave us this signal being the strongest, gave us a really good picture of that. Sometimes we see a signal from two black holes that have very different masses. Maybe one is 10 times more massive than the other, and that seems also to be quite rare. So when we get a signal like that, we get very excited.
Now, I've got here the magazine. It's actually The New Scientist. The headline, the cover story is "The True Nature of Time. The way our universe ticks forward has defied physics until now." And they're saying quite often in the popular press that you're getting a new understanding of the universe and therefore time, because even the expansion of the universe is being argued about, talking about the rate at which the expansion is happening. Are you learning, in other words, via this sort of work, that the universe is different from what you suspected?
Yes. There are two aspects to these questions. The signal that we are observing themselves lasts for maybe a second from black holes merging. So during that time, the universe hasn't expanded much. We don't learn something from the signal itself. However, there is another aspect, that those signals came to us from very far away. So in the time they were traveling toward us, the universe was expanding. So even though one individual signal from these black hole mergers cannot tell you about the expansion of the universe on its own, if you combine a lot of them together and compare where they're coming from, the distances from which they're coming from, and compare that to what we see in the universe, we see where the galaxies are. If we also get a handle of where the gravitational wave signals are coming from, that gives you a handle on the expansion of the universe and what exactly happened between us and them as they were traveling towards us. This is a good example of one of those aggregate properties, the demographics of black holes I was talking about, something you won't get from one signal, but something that you get from looking at a lot of them together and understanding the relation between them.
Which is why you keep going. And are you getting a picture that defies, you know, when you joined Caltech 10 years ago? Is your picture of the universe different now?
No, not from gravitational waves. Everything looks consistent. We need numbers. We need a lot of these detections to understand both the systematics better, the measurement itself, but also to build confidence in any result, beat down all the uncertainties in the experiment. And currently, we have hundreds of detections of black holes. The field is expanding extremely rapidly, and we expect to get hundreds more in the coming years. And we always continually looking for these signatures.
Dr. Katharina Haniowanu, gravitational wave astrophysicist at Caltech. And you're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National. It's the most successful scientific theory in history. Who would dare say something as brave as that? No, not the orange fellow who calls himself a stable genius, but the physicist from Arizona, Adelaide and London, Dr. Paul Davies, who really is brilliant, as you'll hear, and whose new book is called Quantum 2. Quantum, now the centenary, and we're here to celebrate via our sister program. Yes, also on Radio National, Naked Scientists, and another dear friend, Naked's presenter in Cambridge, Chris Smith.
First, to give you a flavour for why the subject he studies even baffled Einstein, consider this. If you take a strip of paper and cut two vertical slits in it, side by side, and shine light through them, like waves washing into the entrances of a harbour, behind each slit you see a pattern of rings. And where those rings overlap and the waves either add together or cancel out, you see bright or dark patches respectively. So what happens if, instead of doing this with light waves, you instead use particles, like electrons or even whole atoms? Well, logic says that a particle would have to go through one or the other slit. It can't be in two places at once, so you wouldn't get that same pattern. But you do. In other words, the atom or the electron must have gone through both slits at the same time, mustn't it? Yes, I warned you this was weird, but stay with me because it gets weirder still. Because if you measure which slit the particle went through, it was either just one or the other. And as soon as you turn that detector on to tell you that, the pattern vanishes. The particle knows you're watching it. Well, welcome to the world of quantum mechanics, a world inhabited by Arizona State University physicist Paul Davies. Paul was born in Finchley, North London, on the 22nd of April 1946. He attended Woodhouse Grammar School and read physics at University College London. From there, his career took him to Cambridge, to Adelaide and Sydney, and latterly, Arizona State University. Along the way, he has probed the origins of the universe, the quantum properties of black hole, and even the nature of time. Paul's written dozens of acclaimed science books. He's produced and presented hugely popular programmes for the BBC and other broadcasters, and his contributions to scientific research and communication have also been globally recognised. He's the recipient of the Templeton Prize, which has also been bestowed upon the likes of Mother Teresa, Dame Jane Goodall, and even the Dalai Lama, with whom Paul has worked in the past. And if that's not enough, Paul even has an asteroid named after him. I'm with him now at the BBC's new broadcasting house in London, not far from where it all began. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back in London, where I come from.
Well, tell us a bit about that intro and getting into science then. How did the story begin?
Very simple. It began in Charing Cross Hospital. I was born a physicist. I never wanted to do anything else. As a child, I was always fascinated by things unseen, looking up at the sky and imagining what might lie beyond what I could see, and then invisible fields, and, you know, anything that was sort of outside of the everyday experience fascinated me. And I suppose that's one reason I became interested in quantum physics. We can't see the weird goings on down at the atomic level.
Who lured you into the quantum realm, though, when you started getting into science at a higher level?
I don't think there was a specific lecturer at University College London. We, of course, had to learn quantum mechanics, I think, in years two and three. I found it inspirational but mystifying. It took a while to wrap my head around it, but I finally did, and it really became an important part of my research.
Niels Bohr allegedly said, if you're not baffled by it, you didn't understand it.
Well, you know, quantum mechanics is one of these peculiar things, the most successful scientific theory in history. And so it explains so much. In fact, the nature of matter all the way from subatomic particles up to stars. And it's given us dazzling technology, things like the laser, transistor and superconductors and MRI machines and quantum dots, high definition televisions. You know, all these things around us are consequences of quantum physics. And yet, deep down, when you actually take a look at it, it doesn't seem to make any sense. It describes a world in which there isn't like a single reality out there. We tend to think, look around us, see tables and chairs, that they really exist independently of us observing them. But when you get down to the atomic level, all that dissolves away, and it's simply not possible to say that a particle like an electron or even a whole atom really is in a certain place or it really is moving with a certain speed. You can look and see, and then what you find is an atom at a place or an atom with a speed, but it's not that our observations reveal or unveil a pre-existing reality. They somehow create that reality through the act of observation. So very mystical. I'm sounding very mystical, aren't I? But that is the standard so-called Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics due to Niels Bohr. And a lot of my colleagues just don't like that at all. And so this is a placeholder for some deeper way of trying to understand what is really going on in the subatomic realm, the quantum realm.
Where did the field actually come from? How did scientists realise there had to be something there that we need to delve into? In other words, when did it get started?
Well, the word quantum was coined by Max Planck, and he was investigating the nature of heat radiation. There was a puzzle in the late 19th century about if you have something like a kiln or an oven, it's got heat radiation trapped within it, and that has a certain spectrum, and nobody could quite understand the shape of that spectrum. It didn't seem to fit with the nature of electromagnetic waves. The other puzzle are atoms. We take atoms for granted these days, but in the 19th century, they were still very hypothetical. Nobody ever seen an atom. But when the electron was discovered, and after all, everyone's familiar with electricity, normal matter is not electrically charged, and so there have to be positive particles. And now we have this model of the atom with a sort of positively charged nucleus, electrons whizzing around it, and that's like a sort of planetary model. The big problem there is that when electrons accelerate, they emit radiation, electromagnetic radiation. That's how you get radio waves. You jiggle electrons up and down in antennae. There's probably one on the roof here. And that's how you transmit radio waves. So when an electron goes round and round in an atom, it ought to be blasting out very high frequency radiation for all it's worth. And then it would go into a death spiral. It would spiral into the nucleus and the atom would collapse in very short order. Clearly, atoms don't collapse. And so the stability of the atom was another big problem. And all of this fell into place when quantum mechanics was developed 100 years ago this year.
What sort of seminal experiments began to be done to show what people said was an extremely weird sector of science?
For me, the starting point of the serious putting together of this quantum mechanics were the experiments with what we might call matter waves. So it was understood that light and other electromagnetic radiation are waves, but it looked, and this was Einstein's idea, it looked that under certain circumstances it could behave more like particles. And we now talk about photons, like little particles of light. So is it a wave? Is it a particle? Nobody could quite make up their minds. But then the same thing happened in the 1920s with matter waves. So firing electrons, or now you can do it even with whole atoms, they have a wave-like character. But surely an electron is a little particle, and yet why does it behave sometimes like a wave? And so this was the starting point, trying to understand what were these matter waves, how could you interpret them? Because they're not like waves of stuff sloshing around. And the answer came in the mid-1920s. These waves, I liken them to crime waves. We talk about a crime wave passing through a city. You don't mean there's some criminality stuff sloshing about. What you mean is that there's an increased probability of a crime being committed. And that's the way we interpret the matter waves. Where the matter wave is strong, there is a greater chance that you will find the particle to be located if you look, if you do a measurement. And so that interpretation of matter waves really set the scene, because now it was possible to explain the stability of atoms, because the electron waves wrap around the atom in certain shapes and patterns, a bit like musical instruments. There are only certain notes that can be played in an instrument. So it's almost like the harmony that is taking place around the atom of these electron waves. And that explains all the energy levels and explains all the observations of spectra and other things. So it all fell into place.
One of the things we did when I was doing physics at school was to shine light waves through slits, and you could see that they form patterns of rings. And if you put the light waves through two slits, you see an overlapping pattern of rings where you get light patches and dark patches. Are you saying that matter particles, because I'm comfortable that how a light wave would do that, are you saying then if you did the same experiment with electrons, particles, I'd similarly see a pattern of rings then, and light and dark patches?
That's absolutely right. What you don't see is light and dark patches. What you can do is count the electrons where they arrive on an image screen, and they build up a pattern in a speckled sort of way. Each electron hits at a certain place, and when you have enough speckles, you see a pattern, just like you do with light. We call it an interference pattern because the waves going through one slit interfere with those going through the other slit. Now, that seems straightforward if we just think in terms of waves, but now what happens if you fire just one electron at a time?
Because that experiment's been done, hasn't it? Oh, yes. We've actually got to the stage where you can say, well, I'll send one electron through at a time. Because the hypothesis would be, if it's a particle, it can only be in one place at a time. If it's a wave, it can go through both slits. So if I fire just one, I should just see one spot in one place.
You're exactly right, and you can do the experiment, and you do fire them one at a time, and you do get a spot in one place. And so a single spot doesn't tell you anything. But when you've got a million spots, one at a time, that accumulated pattern shows the interference fringes. And you might think, well, why can't I just station some little device near the slits and figure out which slit it's going through? Because surely it can only go through one and not both. And if you do that, the pattern goes away.
So the electron knows you're watching?
Yes, sort of. It does seem very creepy. And you can do it with photons as well. And with photons, it's even more spectacular because you can send a photon through a slit system like that and then through a crystal that makes one photon split into two. And one of these photons can go to the image screen where you're going to record the pattern, and the other can go off to Albania or somewhere. And you can do a measurement on the Albanian photon that tells you which slit the photon went through. And when you do that, when you choose to make that measurement, you don't see the pattern.
So hang on a minute. I shine light through a slit and I put a crystal behind that splits the original photon into two. So I've got two new photons, one that goes to the screen that I'm watching, one that goes to a detector. If I don't have the detector turned on, I get a nice pattern as though there was no detector there, no crystal there, like the normal experiment. The minute I turn the detector on, it goes away.
Well, you have to interpret this very carefully. It's not the minute you turn the detector on. It's when you have recorded that information, when you go back and sit down with your accomplice in the lab saying, show me the results of your counting on the image screen, you see that there is a correlation and that on the occasions when you got the information about which slit the photon went through, it doesn't contribute to the pattern and vice versa. And it's even more creepy than that because there's something called the quantum eraser experiment where what you do is you get the information and potentially it's available to you, but then you erase it before you can inspect it. And under those circumstances, the interference pattern remains. These experiments have been done. This is not just some mystical mumbo jumbo I'm talking about. This is real physics, and not only real physics, but physics which is now used in technology, because all of this stuff that we're talking about, and often a lot of it goes under the term entanglement, because the photon over here is entangled with a photon over there. This entanglement is the basis of a lot of what I call quantum 2.0, things like quantum computing and teleportation and the quantum internet, quantum cryptography. It uses this entanglement as a resource to be exploited. So you can monetize the weirdness of quantum physics, which initially, of course, was only investigated just to try and settle arguments about what is really going on in the quantum realm.
But Einstein was skeptical, wasn't he? He dubbed this spooky action at a distance, the photon knowing that you're measuring its counterpart and therefore erasing the information, the pattern. He was uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, Einstein didn't like quantum mechanics right from the outset. God does not play dice with the universe was a famous quote, because what we're talking about here is results which are probabilistic. I mentioned that earlier. These are statistical results, and he never liked the idea that nature is not fully determined down at the microscopic level. So he dreamt up an experiment in 1935, which we would now call entanglement, with two photons or two electrons, doesn't matter, that fly apart. And then you have two, you know, Alice and Bob, they're usually called, and they can perform measurements independently on their respective photons. But the key thing is they can change their minds at the last minute. So, you know, Alice and Bob might say, well, we'll measure the momentum of each particle and we'll compare, or we'll measure the position or something like that and we'll compare. But Alice might say, no, I've changed my mind and I'll measure something else. And Einstein was of the opinion that that only made sense if the particles already possessed definite values of those quantities. But according to Niels Bohr, particles do not possess properties in advance of you measuring them. It's not fair to say that when you do the measurement, you're simply uncovering what already exists. Somehow you bring it into being. And Einstein hated that idea, and he called it spooky action at a distance. But the final point about this sort of Alice and Bob and opposite sides of the lab is those experiments have been done and in the 1980s, and Einstein got it wrong. It is, in fact, the case that the properties of the particles, what you choose to measure, are brought into existence by the act of measurement, and they're not already there from the get-go when the particles fly apart from the common center. So somehow the experiment or the measurement is bringing into being the reality of these separated particles. It seems a bit like telepathy, and some people mistakenly think you can send information faster than light that way. You can't do that, but there is a correlation between these separated events that cannot be explained by saying that these particles had really existed in well-defined states prior to being measured. Schrödinger's cat was another way of illustrating the weirdness of quantum mechanics by saying, well, it's all very well down at the level of atoms and photons and so on, but at what point, when you consider larger and larger objects, do these quantum effects go away? And Schrödinger had this idea of incarcerating a cat in a box. I should say, for cat lovers, this is a thought experiment only. I'm told that Schrödinger did have a cat when he was living in Oxford called Milton. And the plan was, you put the cat in the box and there's a radioactive source and a vial of cyanide, a 50% chance that, say, after 1 minute, the source has decayed and triggered the hammer that smashed the cyanide and kills the cat. But if you seal the box, if you consider it a sort of totally isolated system, you have to conclude the cat is both alive and dead at the same time with a 50% probability. It's in a hybrid, it's an amalgam of alternative realities. You open the box and see, and then the quantum state collapses into either one or the other. But in the absence of the observation, it's an amalgam of both. And that just is a way of illustrating that surely somewhere between atom and cat, this theory breaks down. And yet many of my colleagues think it doesn't break down. They think it applies to the universe as a whole, and that the only way of making sense of Schrödinger's cat is to suppose that there are two universes, one with a live cat and one with a dead cat.
Classic stories and more from Dr. Paul Davies and Chris in 2 weeks' time after Easter on what quantum, that most successful theory ever, is achieving to change our lives.
Now, a small spark of hope in this tumultuous world we're living in. Last week, Robin, you spoke to Professor Jennifer Verdwin from Murdoch University about the wonders and importance of seagrass meadows. I recently spoke to another seagrass researcher from WA, Nicole Sedd from Edith Cowan University. She led a study as part of her PhD looking into how seagrasses cope with heat, and she found some potentially promising news.
I think when I first started my journey in marine science, I didn't know much about seagrasses. Like most people, I kind of thought about dugongs or turtles or even coral reefs. But as I started to learn more about seagrasses, I just was so interested in them. They're such special plants.
What makes them special?
So seagrasses are exactly the same as the plants that we have on land, except they grow under water in the ocean. They have leaves, roots, rhizomes, flowers, and they're actually more closely related to the plants that we have on land, like the ones that grow in our backyard, like lilies and orchids, than seaweeds that also grow in the ocean.
You and your colleagues recently studied different species of seagrasses that live along the Western Australian coast. Why did you choose to focus on those West Coast species?
As the ocean is warming, Western Australia is one of those regions that is a hotspot for warming. And we're also seeing more intense and frequent marine heat waves here. So essentially hotter warmers that are lasting for longer periods of time. So marine heat waves, you can kind of think about them as underwater bushfires. So it's an intense period of heat that warms up the ocean quite quickly, and they can last for weeks to months.
When you say heats up the ocean, what temperatures are we talking about here?
It can get up to temperatures up to 5 degrees above average, and 5 degrees may not sound as much in air temperatures, but in the ocean, temperatures are generally quite stable. So an increase in 5 degrees at that rapid rate can be really impactful for the ecosystems and the things living below the ocean.
Mm. Well, I imagine, you know, if my internal body temperature went up by 5 degrees rapidly, that would be a terrible thing.
Yeah, not great. And unfortunately, in Western Australia, we have had some devastating marine heatwave impacts. And so there's one location in particular, Shark Bay, and there was a marine heatwave that happened in 2010. And it's one of the largest seagrass meadows in the world in Shark Bay. And we lost about 25% of our seagrasses from the single marine heatwave event that happened. We lost 75,000 football fields worth of seagrass in that one marine heatwave event. So pretty devastating impacts.
What does a dead seagrass plant look like?
Yeah, it kind of looks like just sticks sticking out of the sediment, brown sticks, brown leaves on the ground. Like you can imagine leaves falling from the tree in your backyard. There's lots of dead leaves in the sediment. Pretty sombering.
Yeah, very obviously dead. What effect does that have on the wider ecosystem and the communities that live within the seagrasses?
Because that happened so long ago, 15 years ago, those meadows are still recovering. They still haven't recovered from that marine heatwave event entirely, but they have shown some recovery. And there are researchers working and community as well working to help restore these meadows. But we know that from that marine heatwave event that there were fishery closures, and those fisheries were still not, haven't been able to open, affected the food source for turtles and dugongs, and also has an effect on the community that live there that is so close within that area as well.
So for your study, you wanted to test how well different seagrass species from different areas could tolerate heat. How do you test that?
So what we did is that we wanted to look at, well, how are these seagrasses going to be impacted from these temperature events? And so we can look at thermal tolerance. And that essentially is, at what temperatures are these seagrass species happiest, and at what temperatures may kill them?
How do you find that out? Is it just a matter of plonking them in baths of different temperatures?
So what we did is that we got these little closed and sealed chambers and put the seagrass species in that and measured their oxygen and then ramped the temperature up to temperatures that may make them happy, and then continuing that temperature increase to ones that would kill them.
What does the oxygen tell you?
It gives us a measure of their photosynthesis or their productivity. So how much energy are they kind of creating in a way?
Okay, so you've got your little chambers and your various seagrasses and you're ramping up the heat. What did you discover?
So if I focus in on one seagrass species, Posidonia, it's about the size of your arm, big and green, kind of waves around. And it grows from Shark Bay in Western Australia all the way around the southern coast up to New South Wales. And so what we might think is that that one species could potentially have the same ability to tolerate temperature impacts across its range. But that's not what we found. We found that in some locations, it was able to tolerate heat better than in other locations. And then from that, we thought, okay, if this one seagrass species can tolerate heat better hundreds of kilometres away, what about just kilometres away right next door? And so then we looked at the heat tolerance of this same species kilometres away, and we also found that they had different abilities to withstand temperature impacts. And that's really important because it now means that even just meadows growing right next door may fare better under marine heatwave conditions. And so potentially we can use those more heat tolerant meadows to build resilience into those less tolerant meadows.
Like basically transplanting the ones that might have some genetic edge over others when it comes to those heat waves.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, how would you be able to, I don't know, I imagine it's sort of similar to transplanting turf on land, kind of hoik them all up by the roots and the soil and plonk them down elsewhere. How do you transplant seagrass?
Exactly that. You gently pick them up. A lot of people have focused in on this research area in particular as well, different ways of planting them, like the spacing is really important. the way you plant them, where you plant them. And you can't just plant seagrasses in any old spot. You kind of want to target areas where they've been living before. So areas where they've been lost, and where we can restore those areas with these more thermally tolerant plants, because they grew there before, so potentially they can grow there again.
Are there any plans to try to transplant some of the more heat tolerant seagrasses and see if they do okay in a neighbouring meadow?
Yes, that's the next thing that we want to work on. We're going to start to roll out some of those trials before we start to try to scale it up in restoration efforts. And even with scaling it up, moving plants, there are some policy issues with that as well. So hopefully policy starts to change to align with some of these larger global issues, such as climate change as well, to be able to facilitate that.
Nicole said, who's studying seagrasses for a PhD at Edith Cowan University.
And Edith Cowan is a world centre for seagrass science. Now, a brief farewell to another superstar of science, Paul Ehrlich, who died on the 13th of March. His impact in the 20th century, both on population and politics, was colossal. And he gave scenarios, he insists on that, not predictions. And here he is on the Johnny Carson Show in 1980, would you believe, deploring our reliance on oil and Iran's goodwill. Paul Ehrlich.
First of all, one has to ask the question of, do the Russians really want the Arabs under their care in order to get the oil, since the Russians have plenty of oil? But do we really want to threaten to blow up the world over a resource which we know damn well is going to be gone in 20 or 30 years anyway? In other words, it's not like we're not sucking that oil out of the ground. Oh, if we started getting smart and becoming independent of that oil reserve, all we're doing is moving the timetable up a little. And to talk about blowing up the world over that, I think, is just crazy. When I see Mr. Brzezinski on the tube.
Well, let's get back our old subject, nuclear power again. We've had the problem of Three Mile Island. Do you think we're going to have to go that way, or we're going to have to go with the other methods?
Well, let's put it this way. We're going to have to keep a lot of options open. Like many other people, I am very disturbed at the present state of nuclear power. I don't think it's an option we should forego entirely. But the thing that concerns me and most other people most about it is the fact that the way we're deploying nuclear power now, we're also essentially handing out atomic bombs to nations that don't have them. And
wouldn't
eventually
they get them sooner or later?
They will get them sooner or later. The point is, we might buy ourselves 20 years to try and get enough politicians together thinking the right way to change the system so that if people, A, won't want them and B, won't need them. In other words, all you can do is buy time. But the critical things about nuclear power now are, number one, proliferation. We don't want to hustle bombs to everybody. We don't want the Ayatollah to have one minute before he has to. There's even a small chance we could keep it away from him and he might disappear before he gets one. I think that would be nice.
Yeah.
The second big problem with nuclear power really is plant safety, and I think all Americans understood the public relations extravaganza the nuclear industry put on for us at Three Mile Island. If they believe it, wow, it really shows how safe it is because we only came within 1 hour of melting it down, well, all right, then believe it. The other two things that are of concern is, do we want more highly centralized energy systems, which nuclear means, in a world of terrorism, and the problem of waste disposal. I happen to believe that problem is probably technically solvable. But there's been so much lying and deceit in the nuclear industry about it. I think even if you had a solution that we all agreed, all scientists agreed was a good one, nobody would want it next door. Nuclear waste is something that everybody is in favor of having nuclear waste stored in somebody else's backyard. Yes, nobody's standing up waving a flag saying, put it here.
Professor Paul Ehrlich, who died earlier this month. And Johnny Carson said having Ehrlich on the show got the greatest response from viewers ever. Next week, the science show comes from Berlin. I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.